Hello, this is Theatre Voice at the Theatre Museum and my name is Alex Sears. Our guest for this session is the playwright Howard Brenton, whose latest play, Paul, is currently enjoying a successful run at the National Theatre. And his most notorious work, The Romans in Britain, is being revived at the Sheffield Crucible. Brenton, of course, is one of Britain's best known and most controversial dramatists. Since his debut in 1969 with alternative theatre pieces such as Christie and Love, he has emerged as one of the country's leading political playwrights. In the 1970s, he broke through into the mainstream theatre with a series of State of the Nation epics, such as The Churchill Play, Weapons of Happiness, Epsom Downs, and Magnificence. This was large-scale work which challenged established myths about Britain by using a style that can best be described as angry humour. He was also written for BBC Television, most recently Spooks, and collaborated successfully with other writers, most notably on Pravda with David Hare in 1985. But it was 5 years before that, in 1980, that he had notoriety thrust upon him when his epic play, The Romans in Britain, was the subject of a private prosecution brought by the late Mrs. Mary Whitehouse, a moral majority campaigner. In the event, the huge scandal was resolved when her prosecution failed, but it was a dangerous moment not only for those involved in the production, but for British theatre in general. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Howard Brenton.
Thank you.
Let's start with Romans in Britain. Thinking back to the first production, could you say something about this play and your original inspiration for it?
Well, I suppose it goes back to when I was about 10 years old and I was sitting in a primary school class in the 1950s. And at the front of the class, there was a big picture, excuse me, of Caesar's legions crossing the Thames. And it was generally thought to be a very good thing, because they brought straight roads, law and order, poetry, and so on. And it's always stayed with me. I became very interested in archaeology, and at one point wanted to be an archaeologist. So the interest was always there. And when Peter Hall, I had a success at the National in 1976 with a play, and Peter Hall said, well, would you write another play for the Olivier Theatre, which was not yet open? And I said, yes, and I had a rush of blood to the head and said, yes, I'll write The Romans in Britain. He said, excellent. He said, quick, you know, the whiplash mind, Peter Hall. He said, how will they talk? And I had an image of Caesar holding a Celtic knife, and being like an archaeologist in a way, interested in how this knife, which belongs to someone they've just killed, was made. That's what interests Caesar. Not the culture, really, but how the knife was made. Not how the person who made it lived. And from that, the play grew.
And it's kind of symbolic of all invasions, perhaps.
Well, not exactly symbolic, because plays are never quite symbolic. You've got to be specific. You try and get characters that live and live particular lives. With the Romans, it was a really very ambitious undertaking that this younger writer than I am now took on, you know, to imagine the lives of British Celts in 54 BC. I had to work on the language. I had to somehow get it to work.
And the first half of the play is about Caesar's tooth.
Well, it's called Caesar's Tooth because he's irritated that his raid into Britain hasn't gone well, really. And he pulls the tooth out and decides to leave our grotty little island, you know. And it's nothing to him, but of course it's death and destruction to the tribes at his fort, because he came with a big force. There were 30,000, you know, 5 legions, 900 ships landed at Deal. It was a big operation, and It sort of went wrong, although he claimed it as a victory.
Mm. And of course, in the play, you show how he turns what is quite a squalid series of massacres into a kind of legend, if you like.
Yes, there were 12 days holiday declared in Rome because of his victorious invasion of Britain, and it was nothing of the sort, really.
Mm, it was just a raid, really.
Success is with us, and the news of success, one of the soldiers says in the play, and the news of success is what matters.
Mm. And that's the first half of the play. The second half is set in Northern Ireland in the early 1980s or late 70s, with some kind of dream episodes set in Anglo-Saxon times. Is that right?
Yes, it's a perverse play, really. I mean, it's big, you know, it's got 58 characters. In the present production at the Sheffield Crucible, we've got 17 actors doubling up like crazy. You should see Sam West, the director, has this wonderful flow chart of entrants and entrances. It is a big undertaking, but it's also oddly domestic in that the first part is set on one day. And the second part is set 100 years after the Romans have left. It's in what we would call the Dark Ages. And it's about really the creation of the myth of King Arthur. But also superimposed on that, I mean, the young playwright is really, really going for it in this play, is also scenes from when the time the play was written, in the late 70s in Ireland. So you have a field in part two, which is both set in 515 AD and in 1980 AD.
Hmm. Could you talk a bit about the politics of the play?
Well, there are two main stories in the play. In the first half, it's about the desecration of a culture. And it's the spine story in the first part is the story of a young druid who is training to become a fully blown druid. It took them years. His life is wrecked by the, is ruined by the, by being raped by, in a kind of grotty, very common war crime, which is nothing to the soldiers. But to him, it's death and it's the end of his culture. And there's a scene, his final scene in the part, he pleads to his fellow cults to become guerrilla fighters. Mm. And they refuse. Because that's too arduous, too terrifying a prospect. They'll just try and survive. So he kills himself. And the point really is that we aren't the survivors of people like Marban, the heroic young druid. We're the our ancestors are the people who ran away. We have the genes of cowards and gentle people in us, not the genes of heroes. Which is one of the points of the play.
Mm. And yeah, of course, what would you say was the point of the Anglo-Saxon strands? Because, of course, a lot of people here have the Anglo-Saxon genes as well.
Yeah, well, that's built around a character called Tom Chichester, who's an army air service intelligence officer who's undercover in Northern Ireland. And he's trying to make contact with an IRA brigade commander called O'Rourke, and his mission is to kill him. And he suffers a kind of mental breakdown, which is a sort of crisis of conscience. Mm. He sees the parallels between Rome and what he's doing, and how we fought the Saxons fought us, and his mind, he becomes agonized and confused. And the whole of the second part, which is almost like a different play, is built around his story. So you have the two stories, really, the young druid and the army intelligence officer in our time.
Yeah, and they both end badly.
They both attempt extreme resolutions to the wreckage caused by the cultural shock of invasion.
Mm. Did you ever have a doubt about equating the British presence in Northern Ireland with a kind of foreign or marauding invasion?
The play is both very specific in a way. You know, it's Celts. I try and dramatise how they think. I try and dramatise Caesar and in a way that hopefully you can begin to understand that extraordinary, almost unknowable historical presence. And also try and understand the situation in 1980 in Ireland. So there are specific references, but also it takes a broader, almost Yeatsian, cast a cold eye on life, on death view as to make it a history play. Mm. So the parallels are there, and they're there in the minds of the people in the second act. You know, when one of the Irish characters says, "What did the Romans ever give us? Concrete."
And, well, the reply to that was also, "What did the British Empire give to its colonies?"
Tribal wars.
Exactly. Yes.
So you know my players better than I do.
I remembered that quote.
Yes.
Anyway, obviously, it's a massive and epic play, and yet it's been, well, it's got so much in it, but yet it's been completely overshadowed in the public mind, in the wider culture, literally by one scene near the beginning, which isn't the climax of the play. It's important because it's the disaster for Marban. But, you know, I'm talking of the rape scene. Why do you think that particular scene became so notorious?
I couldn't understand it when it happened. Mm. It was like walking underwater. You thought, where am I? What's going on? Why can't we breathe anymore about this this project? No, I mean it was strange. I mean the two things. One is that I've been writing for 10 years, just over 10 years, and I came out of the experimental theatre of the 1960s, when it was almost shocking to go to shows where people had clothes on. The Living Theatre, La Mama, The People Show, these fantastic experimental, libertine, no-holds-barred, let's change the theatre inside out, experimental theatre groups. And I came from that world, and I was, I suppose, trying to bring what I knew and saw and bring what I knew onto a mainstream stage. And so there was a kind of culture shock there, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Also, within the scene itself, it observes how casual the Roman soldiers are. Yeah. They have, to them it's nothing what they're doing, mm-hmm. absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. It's almost just getting people out of the way so they can have a swim. Mm-hmm. In doing that, they kill two people and sexually assault a third, and they have their swim. And they do that with a rough, squaddy humour. And it's a remorseless 2 or 3 minutes, because they know not what they do. But to Marban, to the young Druid, it is the end of his life. It's a desecration beyond all reason, and that desecration continues when he's taken before Caesar in the later scene, and Caesar ties the image of Venus, who is Caesar's ancestral goddess, around Marban's neck to make the point that his religion and his world is over. So, but it's that casualness, that two world touch, shock in the scene, which is very startling. Because it is a brutal scene, and its tone is unnerving. My fellow playwright, Edward Bond, came down to see it, and he said, "Well, Howard," he said, "take all those squatty gags out of the scene, and you'll be left with a work of art, and it'll be acceptable."
Yes.
But with the observing the reality of what happens in a common war crime, after all, we have been through the Bosnian War, and we've the incidents in Abu Ghraib jail, exactly the same.
Yeah, it's that kind of jokey
exactly
quality.
The same. The American Guards, it was maybe a boring Friday night. They got a bit pissed. They got the prisoners out and had some fun. Mm. To them, it was nothing. Mm. It was just worth taking a few photos by their phones, you know. It was that trivial to them. Mm. Of course, to the prisoners, one can only speculate on the trauma it caused them.
Mm. And I suppose it's that imbalance between the two sides that affects the audience, because, you know, they're
yes,
more...
Yes, though you see, audiences are very grown up, you know. I mean, it's what people want to... People get hysterical trying to stop audiences see something or to try and tell them what to think about something. But actually, people who sit through a play, you know... are there for a night out, you know, and you'd have a good night out at a tragedy. Mm. Something very strange about the theatre, the way the most extreme things in human behaviour can be oddly cheering. Mm. You know, even Titus Andronicus, when you see a good production of it, has an extraordinary sort of waking up feeling to it, you know. You go very happily to the pub afterwards.
Now, legally, this prosecution or persecution by Mary Whitehouse was quite interesting because she didn't attack the play on the grounds that it was breaking any obscenity law, but she... Could you talk us through it? I think she...
Well, she was a campaigner for censorship. She wanted to morally control the nation. From her point of view... the nation was going to pot in the end of the 70s, that literally to pot in some ways. And immorality was breaking out everywhere. And this was sapping the moral strength of the nation, which is a very right-wing idea, you know. It's a very right-wing notion that there is something called the moral fibre of the nation, and it can be decayed by artists, broadcasters, sexual freedoms. No, the Nazis thought this. I'm not saying she was a Nazi, but this is a very common European puritanical mindset. Yeah. And so I think she was looking for a good case, really, to be honest. I think it was leeching on our play, taking our energy. If the play had gone on at the Bush Theatre or the theatre upstairs, you wouldn't have had Mary Whitehouse sending
it. It was because it was at the National.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that she chose this law, which is usually used for hounding people who are picking up somebody in a public lavatory or who are doing something in a back alley, and applied it to a theatre piece, which is actually, after all, fiction. So wasn't she sort of assuming...
Well, it was rather nasty. I thought rather sneaky, because she had insisted on the police going down three times to view the play. Three times the vice squad had to sit through my play. Poor sods, you know. And each time they said, no, there's nothing to prosecute under the perfectly adequate laws that the government, that govern decency in public performances, that there's no case to answer. And then it all went quiet, and we thought we were through the worst, and the play was doing reasonably well in the repertoire, and then suddenly we got this.
And what exactly happened?
Well, we were having a drink in the green room, Bogdanov and I, with some of the actors, and we were celebrating because Peter Hall had said, well, it's doing well enough at the box office, I'm going to extend it. And so we said, great. And then a message came saying, there is a man at the stage door for you, Michael. And Michael Bogdanov went down, and he was served a writ. What she'd done was she'd gone through the laws of old England to try and find a way of getting at us. And she'd found this way of arguing that to cast an actor in a play is the same as pimping a prostitute. Now, you have to have a particular kind of rather labyrinthine and dark mind to conceive of that notion.
And for that reason, by you almost ignoring the fact that it was art and trying to turn it into a real life, if you like, event, she prosecuted the director, Michael Bogdanov, and not you, is that right?
Yes, well, there was no way of getting at the playwright, but there was this strange way of getting at Michael. You know, I mean, in terms of getting real, you all always, in all arts, be it novels or plays or films, the advances are made when people, not by being expressionist or worrying about form, but trying to get things that bit more real, that bit nearer reality in life. And that's what you're always trying to do. And that's only what the play was trying to do.
Mm. But it must have felt bad for you to have Bogdanov waiting for his trial for a year. And did you ever feel responsible? Or
yes, I felt very responsible. What I did was I consulted lawyers and I went on a reading tour. I read the play as a one-man show. I think I had 12 gigs in a fortnight. To raise money, because in case we needed the money to pay the lawyers off. Mm. And it was the only thing I thought I could do. I couldn't talk about the play from the stage, but I could read it.
Is that because it was so soon to say?
Yes. Mm. And that was what I did. We ended at the Old Vic with some of the actors taking part, and it was a great experience, but it was a very difficult time. It wasn't pleasant, you know. And it was terrible for Michael.
Mm. Yes, I remember. I mean, because he faced going to jail after all.
He could have gone to jail for 2 years.
Did you ever have very dark moments when you despaired about the whole thing?
No, I mean, we just fought it through. I always had a kind of faith the ludicrousness of it would become apparent. And in a way it did in the end.
Mm. And were you actually there in court when the case was dropped?
Yes, I could. I could go into court. I was going to be a witness, so I couldn't sit in the court until that time. But yes, I was.
Yeah. And why did the case collapse finally? Was it the thing about the finger and...
No, Mary Whitehouse's lawyer, apparently... went to the judge and said, I cannot continue with this prosecution. And if a prosecuting lawyer says that, the judge has to find a way of stopping it. And they found a very complex way of stopping it. But that, in essence, as far as I could understand it, is what happened.
Because I read that actually they weren't confident because the person they'd sent, who was their star witness, and said that there was an erect penis on stage and was sitting so far away from the stage that actually he mistook a finger protruding from a fist for another part of the anatomy. And he was sitting so far away that it was ludicrous.
Well, all theatre's illusion.
Exactly.
You know, there is no one called Hamlet, you know. There really isn't. There is no such person.
And she just gets up at the end of the play.
You have to remember that. You know, these characters on the Archers and East Enders, they do not exist. Sending them wreaths when they die is surreal.
Well, are you pleased with this revival now that you're having?
Oh, yes. I'm very... pleased that a new generation are going to do it, and hopefully it'll be seen as a play. I mean, good or bad, a night out to, you know, to forget or to remember, and not because something strange happened to the play. I think philosophers call it. It was reified, that is, changed into something it wasn't, and it became either a kind of, for some, a cause, and for other, an outrage. And not a play, you know, not in the end, even a war play like this is an entertainment. Yeah. And it became something else. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it'll be returned to being an entertainment, albeit a, you know, broiling one by a very ambitious writer written 25 years ago.
For this revival, were you ever tempted to rewrite the rape scene or drop it or...
No, because I thought the first part works perfectly well. I've done a little rewriting in part two to make the story clearer. Because artistically, I mean, you know, in terms of dramaturgy, part two is incredibly ambitious in what it's trying to do. Its tone is very different. It's multi-stranded. It's picking up echoes from part one. And it's plugged into the play's present.
And didn't you sort of occasionally feel that maybe all this story of Northern Ireland now after the peace process is also becoming history? In other words, in the 25 years, something that was contemporary is now a historical moment.
Yes, it may be viewed as just a history play. And in that we were, our army was fighting in Ireland against an insurgency. And that time has ceased. So, yes, it may look just like a history play. I can't tell. It's up to people who go and see it.
Yeah, but it certainly has still some kind of resonance, I'm sure, because I don't have to tell you about the line that where it's often repeated, in fact, when will the war end? And doesn't that sort of resonate to us now with Iraq and the Middle East and so on?
It may. Yes, it may.
Okay. Talking of the Middle East, maybe we could have a look at Paul, which is really the Romans in Judea. And why did you decide to write a play about St. Paul?
Well, I had a religious background. I was from a Methodist family. And although I became a really difficult, irreligious, dissenting from the dissenting church teenager, which all calmed down. I reconciled with my father, with whom I had many arguments. But because of that, I always wanted to write something about religion. And I didn't want to write about my father, who was a Methodist minister. I wanted to write about, to find a way of writing about it. And I suddenly saw a way of doing it. Oddly, because I've been working for television, and television sharpens your sense of form and storytelling. And I suddenly saw a way of doing it as a prison drama. Yeah. And that was the key to how to write such a difficult, you know, how do you put St. Paul on the stage? You know, it's tricky.
In the programme you say, you know, matter-of-factly, there is no God. So am I right to think that you're an atheist?
Yes. What interested me was how, if you take it as a given that the resurrection of Christ did not happen, if it did not happen, how did the huge, powerful panoply of Christianity, which is still with us and still virulently in the world in different forms, you know. But how did that take off? Someone must have told a lie. Why? How? Under what pressure? And I was trying to look at that, how a myth is born. And I thought a lot about how you can believe, how we all do, how you can believe two things at once, how you can both know that he didn't come out of the tomb and at the same time believe that he did. That's what I was trying to dramatise, that state of mind and the pressure that out of which faith is born. And great philosophers have written about this, particularly Kierkegaard, the leap into the dark, which faith is. Despite everything that is apparent, I believe. And that's what I was after putting that on the stage. Because I think it's a key to fundamentalist thought.
Mm. And it's interesting that, in a way, you've returned to Romans in Britain because you're examining how a myth is born. In Romans in Britain, it's the myth of King Arthur.
Yes.
And it's almost born casually.
Yes.
Almost just as a compensation, something to do. Mm. Well, the world is changing. And here you have a similar idea of a society in crisis.
Yes.
where the myth is actually necessary. People need it. Is that right?
Yes, and it gets out of hand. The early Christian church in Jerusalem, Yeshua, or Jesus's brother, James, cannot control the belief in the resurrection, although he knows it himself to be untrue. He nevertheless almost ends up preaching it. He's a tragic figure in the play, beautifully played by Paul Higgins, by the way.
And there's that wonderful scene at the end between Paul and Peter, the kind of convert and the apostle, where the truth of the whole thing comes out gradually. And I suppose towards the end you're suggesting very powerfully that Kierkegaardian leap is necessary, especially if you have to face death the next day.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I wanted to bring Paul right up to face the reality of Jesus's actual death and reject it or go beyond it. And that's what I was after. I was also interested that it's not a satire in any way on Paul, and it's not really an attack on him, because he invented the world we live in several crucial ways. He was a moral genius. He invented the idea of the self. He also invented the idea of what we call love. I've had a wonderful exchange with a Jewish scholar about saying, no, the Pauline idea of love is in the Old Testament. And to say, where? And she sends me quotes almost regularly, and I reject them, saying, no, this isn't love, this is duty, or whatever. It's an interesting debate. But I do see Paul as a moral genius. And for good or ill, he said, it's because I know it myself, his great defense in Corinthians, which I'm sure is what he said to the Jerusalem church when he had the great row with them, the trace of which is in the Acts of the Apostles, that he said, I have it personally. It's not been taught me, he says, by any man. I have it personally from Christ that he is risen. And it's that personal belief, that personal instinct, which we live by, really. I wake and I am convinced I am a good person is fundamental to Western shopping.
But it's also, more seriously perhaps, fundamental to Martin Luther.
Yes, here I stand, I can do no other. And also his great meditation on the letter to the Romans. Yes.
And also, if you think that Paul preached for some 30 years after conversion, it's a long time, and it's also a time when he must have had some doubts. Or do you think he was always fueled by this immensely strong inner certainty?
I think he was all. I think I doubt whether he had wobbles. He has certain wobbles, which is exhaustion. You could sense the irritability in the letters.
Yes.
The letters are all written to deal with specific problems. He was fed up, clearly, with people talking about meat and sex. He was sort of bored with... because he believed the world was about to end.
Yeah, quite. Well, that's the other strand, isn't it? It's the personal relationship with God, love, but then also this sense of imminent apocalypse, which means, well, you've got to do something.
His letters
about
are
it.
Shot through with it. And it is, Peter does confront him about it, saying, after 30 years, surely.
Well, that's one of the ghastly things.
Nothing has happened, he shouts at Paul. You know, can't understand what the problem is. He lives in an a present in which Christ is about to appear at any moment.
And that actually must have been the experience of countless apocalyptic fantasies over the centuries.
Oh, I think born-again Christians have it, have a sense that Christ is there at any moment. Glory is going to break out. It's a common psychological state.
Yeah, it's kind of worrying when perhaps the leaders of the free world also have that. Once again, though, from Caesar and his tooth, we've got Nero and his mask. So what is it with you and Roman emperors? he's immensely appealing, Nero. And what he says is a fantastic kind of icing on the cake. Was he there from the beginning of the play? Or?
Yes, I always wanted to end it with him.
Yeah.
See, I wanted our world to enter and say, what are you all talking about? Yeah. And I thought Nero was the person to do it.
Oh, absolutely.
The most loathed and reviled creature of Roman history, probably rightly. But I also think he probably was, all of those from that house, that dynasty, which I think was the last, the Augustan dynasty, they, you know, came from Caesar, that were politically brilliant people. They had to be to survive. And there's probably Nero was done down by the people who took over from him. His reputation was certainly flattened. They destroyed his house almost immediately. So I was interested. I thought I'll make him the chairman of the board. That's what I thought.
Well,
I'd
he's got a fantastically clear-eyed vision of the potential of Christianity to be a state religion.
Yeah.
And he understands the idea of authority, which a person in his power respects. So it has a real counterpoint to that more subjective idea of
faith. Well, there is an American ideologue. His name is Otto Strauss. I think I got the name right. And he was behind a lot of the Bush administration's thought, which was saying, look, people have to be controlled. The controlling thing in America, the controlling mechanism, is religion. So maybe the White House is not raving fundamentalist. Maybe it's deeply cynical, just as Nero in my play is really deeply cynical about state power and religion.
Once again, a controversial play, but this time before it was put on, I heard that some 200 letters of complaint were sent to the National about it, and that people, once again, their imaginations were running right ahead of yours. They assumed it would be a gay Paul or a dreadful satire or something. So how do you explain that kind of gut reaction?
Well, I suppose it looked like a really poisonous, no, I won't say poisonous, incendiary equation, didn't it? Howard Brent, an author of the Romans, plus Nick Heitner, producer of Jerry Springer, the opera, times St. Paul equals an outrage beyond all imagining. And so I think they began to get on the phones and get their word processors out to, get the emails off. Our worry was that, again, it would be reified. That is, turned into something it wasn't, because really it's quite a rational play. It invites debate. It's there to encourage thought about religion and where we are with it and what belief is. I've had lots of very interesting conversations with Christians about it. And we were very concerned that we protected the play so as much as possible, so it could open, and then people would say, well, this isn't actually the incendiary cocktail produced by this equation at all, even though Nick was saying it wasn't. Also, in these campaigns, you do notice that the many letters are all curiously almost exactly the same letter.
The email is
in the
wonderful
world of emailing. You know, I mean, I've done it myself. I remember doing one to the Polish government a few years ago. And say, could you email this? You say, yes, dear Minister of Culture. And
off it goes.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you said it was a serious play, and it is, because it does talk seriously about this whole idea of faith. Because there is an argument that you should say that you believe in something, even when you don't, with the hope that it will come. And do you think that that's one of the dilemmas that those early Christians faced?
It's difficult to get into the classical mind. You could believe something which you also knew was not true, and that's also can be believed today. But also, they would do things like, for example, the speeches of Socrates on his death. There are four speeches that he makes at his trial, and they're not only different, they are nothing like each other. The greatest is Plato's. And he wrote it because that's what the great hero says at his trial. And there's speeches of heroes at Marathon and, you know, in Herodotus. They aren't history at all. Herodotus wrote them because the hero must speak. And it's a mechanism which is a kind of thinking which is difficult to get your head around. And so In the New Testament, there must have been 12 disciples. Why? Because they're 12 tribes of Israel. And so they're obviously they're 12 disciples. It's not an historical fact. There's a technical word for it, a pesha, which means a hidden significance to everything. And Jesus must be born in Bethlehem because he's of the house of David. Therefore, he goes to Bethlehem for the census. There was a census, but the Romans did census. A census was done by Rome exactly as they are in now. You know, they knocked on the doors and said, "Who's living here?" You didn't have to go to the home. But that's not the point. The point is this has to be so, and you know, it's a sense of reality that is almost lost to us. It's out of that world that belief in Christ's resurrection comes.
And that's really interesting, because what you're really saying is that perhaps we've grown more literal-minded as we've grown more...
No, I think we're more enlightened.
All right.
Okay. I believe in intellectual progress despite all the setbacks. I believe the Enlightenment has woken us up in a way that we weren't awake 2,000 years ago.
Let's turn to another bit, which was this kind of slightly almost blasphemous statement, I think, about the Virgin Mary's ear and so on. And also the marriage of Christ to Mary Magdalene. Obviously, everyone's familiar with that from the Da Vinci Code. Is that where you got it from, or was this something that...
Oh. I had this when I thought, oh, what a terrific idea, I thought. Then I read the book about, you know, after I'd finished the play. And
all right.
Sod, you know. But there are traces, they're just traces in the stories, which make you wonder. Jesus was 30, and a 30-year-old would marry in that culture. Paul probably didn't marry because of his illness. But Jesus was 30 and a preacher, he would almost have to be married. You know, I mean, it would be almost unacceptable that he wasn't married, which is interesting.
You can't imagine him cooking his own baked beans.
And then there is this wonderful reading of this isn't my reading, I got it in a rather weird book, of the wedding at Canaan, where Jesus is at a wedding party and the wine runs out. And Jesus's mother, Mary, calls for more, says, "The wine has run out, what are we going to do?" And Jesus performs a miracle. He turns water into wine so the party can go on. The interesting thing about this is that it is an immemorial tradition that Jewish wedding parties are organized by the bridegroom's mother. And that's why in the Gospel, Mary's mother calls out for more wine. Now, isn't that great? It's one of these little hooks in the old text.
Also, I suppose dramaturgically, in a very male dominated play, the actual character of Mary Magdalene is almost a breath of fresh air.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you feel that when you were writing it? Because she has some good jokes.
Well, again, if you say, well, if he was married, how... your thought runs on, you know. I mean, I'm a dramatist. I'm not an historian or a theologian or a moralist, really. It's just you ask these questions and try and dramatise them. And it is interesting thing. Well, if he was married, how would they write her out of history? Why would they? And it's essential that she should be written out. I mean, that's really an authentic argument because it's a tautology. Well, you know, maybe she wasn't there anyway, you know, as his wife. But it is that I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I gave her speech comes, really, mm-hmm. where she says, if he has to turn into something called Jesus Christ, in front of our eyes it's happening. And that thing is nothing to do with the man we knew.
And the final question about your upbringing and so on, were you ever worried that it was a bit blasphemous, anything that you were saying or...
Oh, no, I hoped it was edging towards some kind of truth about the origins of Christianity and why faith is so dangerous.
Mm. Mm. Good. That sounds like a good place to end it. On behalf of Theatre Voice at the Theatre Museum, thank you very much, Howard.
Thank you.
Thank you.